Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Mary Ellen Hannibal. It is my huge pleasure to introduce you to Rebecca Moore tonight. Charles Dickens' famous encomium, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times," referenced the French Revolution, but it finds even greater application to our world today. Luckily for all of us, Rebecca Moore and her team at Google Earth Outreach are not only helping find solutions to some of the globe's most intractable problems, but she is doing so in a way that empowers the individual and the community to take change into our own hands. After a protracted, most of us use Google Maps to get directions to find a new restaurant or to find out where we're going. It was Moore's brilliance, really, that led her to show the Google Earth people that the ability to fix localities in space and time has incredible power to help us identify and change social and political impacts that shape our world today. Rebecca stopped the mountaintop logging of in her neighborhood in the Santa Cruz Mountains and using Google Earth technology. She also helped map genocide in Darfur, showing the world that not only, yes, such a thing was happening, but exactly where. Just this week, Moore and activist partners launched an initiative to track illegal fishing around the world, lending the power of real-time and real place data to help enforce protection of our oceans ecosystems. Another signature project of Moore's empowers the brilliant Brazilian Surai people to report illegal logging of their tribal homeland in situ. Again, real time, real place data applied to make real change. It's a bit of a challenge to keep up with Moore's projects and ambitions. Recently, she was featured in James Cameron's Showtime series, Years of Living Dangerously. She was pointing out a thing or two to Harrison Ford. She can point out a thing or two to all of us. And I think you can still see that episode on YouTube. So tonight, we are in the company of a real game changer. Seriously, a person who will go down in history as having helped change its course for the better. It is my profound privilege to welcome Rebecca Moore.
Thank you so much, Mary Ellen. You are absolutely too generous. And thank you to all of you for coming out on this rainy evening. Isn't it great that it's finally raining in California? So there's an experiment going on right now. What happens when you put in the hands of the world the most vivid, realistic digital replica of the planet that has ever existed before, with high-resolution satellite imagery, 3D topography, map data, and the ability for you to navigate through that in this 3D world as if you're piloting your own helicopter. So when Google Earth first came out in June of 2005, most people kind of opened it up once and they said, what can I do with it? You know, the first thing you do, you fly to your home and then you look at your neighbor's backyard from space, right? How many people have actually tried using Google Earth? Yes. Or people try to figure out where to go on vacation. You know, is that hotel really on the beach or is it actually behind a landfill, you know? And so I had just started working at Google when Google Earth came out, and I live in the Santa Cruz Mountains where we have a lot of challenges. And I ended up as a reluctant activist using Google Earth as a tool, as Mary Ellen mentioned, to save the redwood forest in my community. And that has led me on this journey that has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and I'm excited to share that with you tonight. And we call it Maps for Good or Geo for Good. So I have a lot of visuals for those of you here today. It started August 2005. 2,000 residents in the Santa Cruz Mountains above Los Gatos opened the mail. I was one of them. And we got this sketchy, grainy, black and white map titled Notice of Intent to Harvest Timber. Okay, let's see. For those of you here, you can see that it's just a lot of black and white lines. It's very difficult to figure out what they're proposing to do and where they're proposing to do it. My neighbors and I were concerned because harvesting timber did not sound like a good thing. So I took this new thing that had just come out, Google Earth, and over a weekend I studied the plan and I remapped the elements of the plan in full 3D on the satellite imagery of Google Earth, just out of curiosity to see, could we actually have better insight into what was at stake if we did that versus this paper black and white map. So let's start. Now we're looking at the same place that's in Google Earth, Los Gatos watershed. And here I brought in an overlay of the logging zone, where the schools and daycare centers are, where the helicopters were going to be landing and taking off, because the land is so steep they couldn't take it out by road. These helicopter landing zones were going to be next to multi-million dollar homes and, as I said, schools and so on. The nice thing about Google Earth is you can also tilt the landscape and look at it in 3D and begin to appreciate the steepness of the land that they were proposing to log. This is what Google Earth looked like circa 2005. This was the time when Al Gore was going around during An Inconvenient Truth. I was going around to, you know, the community centers and neighbors' homes and churches and schools and politicians invited to show the Google Earth logging flyover because nobody could understand this plan. It was a 400-page document with the sketchy information and no one could understand it. So it began to get noticed in the local press, right? Empowering public participation with Google Earth, internet and democracy, and this is the theme that started to emerge of raising awareness using this tool. The San Francisco Chronicle said desktop satellite tools are changing the way environmentalists work. They said environmentalists used to sit in trees. Now they sit in front of Google Earth. The Wall Street Journal wrote, activists start Googling, right? Internet maps illustrate environmental woes. In other words, you can see with your own eyes what's at stake. Technology builds bigger soapbox. This was, I thought, a great insight because we actually used Google Earth to enlist the support of Al Gore, who was a senior advisor at Google, and he came out and gave us support, a press release, which also gave us a lot of attention. Now we're on the news.
We're taking a Google Earth virtual flyover along a 5-mile length of Los Gatos Creek between Lexington Reservoir and Lake Elsman in the Santa Cruz Mountains. The area in red, totaling 1,000 acres, is land that San Jose Water Company wants to log. The map was created by a software engineer who lives in the area, and it's being used to galvanize opposition to the company's plans.
So instead of having an abstract map, people can see their houses, see their schools, see where the logging zone is, and it changes an abstract concept to something that is quite striking.
And that is the key number one insight is it changes something abstract to something that is concrete, striking, and actually can move people emotionally. This ended up galvanizing my community to get engaged and to understand the issues. And eventually we used Google Earth not only to show that this plan was a bad idea, but that it was in fact illegal. Yes, and so it took 2 years. But we proved using Google Earth it was illegal, and we stopped the logging. You're supposed to cheer now. Yay! So that got a lot of attention. My phone started ringing off the hook, and my email at Google, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, and so on, all over the world saying, you know, we thought we might be able to use Google Earth in some way for our environmental campaign, but now seeing what you did, would you please teach us? How did you import the data into Google Earth? How did you make the animated flyover? How are you presenting it to the politicians? Would you give us advice and tips and so on? And I thought, well, listen, I work at Google now. Instead of emailing everybody back, why don't we create kind of a program, a site, resources? And that led to Google Earth Outreach, which anyone can go to earth.google.com/outreach, and there's tons of resources that teach you how you can also use Google Earth, Google Maps in your community to raise awareness and map and visualize issues. So there's thousands of nonprofits now. For example, I got a phone call shortly after our victory. Rebecca, this is Woody. I'm like, the Woody? Woody Harrelson? Yeah. I'm sorry, Woody. It's a very bad imitation. But, you know, he said, you know, I saw what you did. You saved the redwoods. That's great. We're trying to stop mountaintop removal in Appalachia. could you help us? I said, well, I don't know. Let me look. So while I'm on the phone, I fly in Google Earth over to Appalachia, and you could see in Google Earth hundreds of dynamited, blown-up mountains. And you could see the debris that had been thrown into the rivers, and it became so much more obvious than it could otherwise be, because these lands are private and you can't otherwise go there, you know, what was at stake. And now that group, Appalachian Voices, that Woody has been supporting, has been using Google Earth in the halls of Congress to raise support for a bill to stop, permanently stop, mountaintop removal coal mining, and they're making a lot of progress. The HALO Trust is one of the oldest, or I think the oldest, largest organization in the world, working on the ground in war-torn regions of the planet to remove landmines and other unexploded ordnance left in the ground after war's over, places like Angola, Afghanistan. Children literally cannot walk to school across a field without fear of their legs being blown off. So the HALO Trust is using Google Earth, the high-resolution imagery, to plan and manage these removals, these removal operations. So here you can see color-coded in green the land that's safe, color-coded in red where they plan to remove the mines. Here is an image, a satellite image in 2002, of an area before they remove the landmines. You can see in the satellite imagery that no one lives there, right? It's too dangerous. Now we go forward 10 years. Here it is after they've removed the mines, and you can see farms, homes, fields that have been, that are showing agriculture. They've been able to return to the land. The next, one of the more interesting projects we got involved with, as Mary Ellen mentioned, was Chief Almir Surui, the first Amazon Indian chief who ever came to Google, came in 2007, and he said, our land is under threat. This was all through translators. Our land is under threat. Our territory is pristine, virgin, and we're doing our best to protect it, but we're completely surrounded, and you can see in the satellite imagery, by deforestation. And he was the first member of his tribe to go to university, and there, he, in an internet cafe, he stumbled on Google Earth. He flew into his home, like we all do, the first time he opened Google Earth, and you can actually see in the imagery places where there are illegal invasions of the land that he didn't even know about. And his father before him had been chief and had used bow and arrow to drive off illegal invaders, but it wasn't working anymore. The tribe was too small to do that. And Almir had the idea, what if we put down the bow and arrow and we pick up the laptop and we use Google Earth as a tool to raise awareness, raise support, show the world what we're doing. So what's been so exciting about that is not only did they have their carbon offsets certified, but they've now sold them to the largest Brazilian cosmetics company for millions of dollars. So no longer are they depending on handouts or worrying about invasion of their land. They're being supported financially for defending and protecting their territory. And Chief Almir reached out to us and asked me to come down and see him in January, which I will be doing, because now many other tribes in the Amazon have contacted him and would like to do the same thing. He said, these tools are giving us control over our own destiny. So fast forward now. So are we done? You know, we've got Google Earth, we've got Google Maps, thousands of organizations, millions of people, a billion people use Google Maps every month. Are we done? Well, no, not at all. Because as you can see in this satellite imagery of Brazil, the Earth is changing dramatically. In just our lifetime, we've lost millions of acres of the rainforest in ways that are observable from space. And so while we were down there doing the training for the indigenous Surui tribe, Brazilian scientists, geoscientists who work on satellite imagery analysis came to us and said, will you help us? We like Google Earth and maps, but you just let us look at imagery and get driving directions. We want to map and measure and monitor the changing surface of the planet. There's millions of acres being lost, you know, of the rainforest every year. The science exists to analyze satellite imagery that's coming in every day and automatically detect where change is happening in remote parts of the rainforest where there's not law enforcement on the ground, and then create a virtual alerting system. But the problem is it's terabytes or petabytes of data, billions of megabytes of data, and it takes weeks to run the analysis on a single computer, and by the time you have the result, it's too late. The loggers have moved up the road to somewhere else. So they said, you know, you have these famous data centers, you have the imagery, let us do science on it. So that was the seed for what we call Google Earth Engine. And my team started the development of that, and that's now been operational for several years. And Google Earth Engine is about doing global scale environmental analysis. So it starts from the fact that, you know, as taxpayers, we have funded incredible satellites that are up there working very hard, even as we are sitting here, collecting, systematically collecting observations of the Earth's surface. They could be photographs, it could be weather data, all kinds of information, sometimes going back 40 years. The problem is that data often comes off those satellites, and in this case goes onto tapes in a vault in South Dakota. Right? This is the U.S. Geological Survey Archive Center. Now, it's fantastic that the U.S. government is collecting this data. They're making it available for free, but as a practical matter, it hasn't been accessible. It's been locked up on these tapes. So that's part of what we did with Google Earth Engine, is we worked for more than 3 years with the government, with USGS. They've been a fantastic partner. We liberated all that data off those tapes. It's now online and available for scientists and researchers and nonprofits to do analysis on that information. When you have all that imagery now, you can do some interesting things. For those of you here, you can see a typical satellite image has lots of clouds. There's not much you can see. But these satellites are collecting multiple images every year over the same place, and clouds move around. So if you have all the pixels, you can imagine sifting through them and finding the best ones and being able to turn an image like this of Borneo into that, where we've removed all the clouds. And then you can start to look at what's going on. Here's what South America used to look like in Google Earth and Google Maps. You can see, for example, Ecuador is just covered with clouds. Now this is what it looks like. And here's what the whole world now looks like in Google Earth and Maps, based upon sifting through quadrillions of pixels to produce the first high-resolution cloud-free image of the whole Earth. So we launched that a year ago, so I encourage you to go check that out. That was the work of Google Earth Engine. That was when my boss, who invented Google Earth, first said, you know, Rebecca, maybe this Google Earth Engine is good for something after all. So then when we had, given that we had decades now of this data that we had from off tape, we wondered, well, could we actually see, could we visualize change? And so we created what we called time-lapse, which is a three-decade interactive animation of the entire surface of the Earth. And you can go to earthengine.google.org, and you can see that. Here we're looking at examples of the retreating Columbia Glacier, deforestation of the Amazon, the creation of the artificial palm islands off the coast of Dubai because they wanted more beachfront for tourism. So there's many, many human impacts on the planet that you can see. This is one of my, I guess, favorites, you could say. We're looking now at Las Vegas, which has been the fastest growing city in the U.S. Through these 3 decades. And what's fascinating to me is in a few seconds you can see Las Vegas growing while Lake Mead shrinks. That's kind of sobering as we try to think about how do we live sustainably on the Earth. So when we launched time-lapse, we did it with Time Magazine, and they did some beautiful science and environmental reporting on what you could actually see for the first time in terms of human impact on the planet. But what I wanted to show here was what it took to build that. It was, as I said, 30 years of data almost, more than 2 million satellite images that we analyzed. It took 2 million hours of computation to sift through all those pixels and make those annual images without any clouds over 30 years. We ran that on 66,000 computers, so we were able to produce this global planetary time lapse in a day and a half. On a single computer, it would have taken 300 years. So now we're talking. So we knew we could do some awesome visualization, right, on these huge global data sets. But again, the reason, you know, going back to why we started Earth Engine, it was to be able to monitor our environment. And that Brazilian scientist, I'm happy to say, Dr. Carlos Souza, has now, for more than 2 years, been using Google Earth Engine to operationally monitor the Brazilian Amazon. And they're producing statistics much faster with much higher resolution than they ever did before. We also worked with Professor Matt Hansen at the University of Maryland to create the first global high-resolution map of forest cover and change. Again, you would think, right, oh, there must be some place you can go and understand where is forest in the world? Where has it been lost over the last, you know, 10 years? There hasn't been such a possibility until this project was done. This was another kind of awesome amount of computing, 10,000 CPUs, 4 days. It would have taken 15 years. I'll stop with the statistics. I think you get the idea. But we published that in Science magazine, and it got a huge amount of attention. Thousands of institutions have now downloaded that data, including developing countries who never had accurate data for their own forests, and now they do. Here's an example of looking at a time lapse of forest loss in Sumatra. So that red is where deforestation has been happening. A tremendous amount of, due to palm oil, a tremendous amount of deforestation, a significant amount illegal, happening in some cases in their national parks. This was featured in that Years of Living Dangerously that Mary Ellen mentioned. Harrison Ford went right into the center of this map to challenge what was being done on the ground. Now, so we did that scientific project, but we want to get this all the way into people's hands, right? That's the goal. We want to make effect change. And what's been fantastic is a partnership with World Resources Institute, who's now taking this and using Google Earth Engine to update this information like every 2 weeks. So you can go to globalforestwatch.org, you can go anywhere and you can see forest cover, forest change. You can subscribe to an area that you want to be notified if something's happening there. Here's an example of what it looks like. You come in and you draw an area, and it tells you right then and there statistics about it. But again, you can also subscribe and be notified. I like this article came out in IEEE Spectrum. They were saying, when a tree falls in the forest these days, it doesn't just make a sound, it causes a computer program to generate an alert that's sent out to activists, researchers, and environmental policymakers around the planet. That's the idea. There have been these dark corners of the planet where nefarious deeds have been going on because people have been able to get away with it, and now I think we can do a much better job monitoring the environment. The government of Indonesia has been desperately seeking tools. They have not had the capacity to properly enforce the law. They're now using Global Forest Watch to do this. It's also relevant to the business community. More than 70% of tropical deforestation is actually due to the production of commodities. Timber, that's obvious, but palm oil, soy, beef, and so on. And again, a lot of that is illegal, but these companies have not had the visibility into their supply chain to know whether the timber they're sourcing is socially and environmentally sustainable or not. Now they do, and because of the possibility they can do this monitoring and the pressure from nonprofit community and so on, all these companies are now making commitments to zero deforestation palm oil. So right now, if you get Girl Scout cookies, there's deforestation in that supply chain, but Nestle's is committed that by 2015, Girl Scout cookies will be deforestation free. And now there are the tools that anyone can verify that they're meeting that commitment. Just a couple of last examples to show. We wanted to go from saving trees to saving lives. And it turns out that many emerging infectious diseases actually can be predicted by environmental factors. So there was a Professor Rita Caldwell discovered that by looking at plankton blooms off the coast of Calcutta from space, she could determine an outbreak of cholera, I think it was 8 weeks later, because there was a correlation between that plankton bloom and the cholera outbreak. So you would think, oh, great, so now there's an operational early warning system for cholera in Calcutta, right? Well, no, that's not her job. She's a scientist. She publishes the paper. She has the core discovery. But there's been that gap. How do we get the science out of the laboratory into the hands of people that will actually use it? So this is a project with UC San Francisco Global Health Program to predict malaria. By looking at things like the greening of the landscape, you can see in the satellite data, temperature, rainfall, distance from rivers, distance of population centers, you can have a pretty good idea of where there's risk of malaria outbreak, and then you can target your intervention. So this was just written up in the San Francisco Chronicle in September. I wanted to end with this example because I find it so kind of shocking. We are not living sustainably. The ocean is not being treated in a sustainable fashion. I know this is not a newsflash for many of you. Something like 20% of the seafood we eat is illegally caught. It's either caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's violating quota. There are many, many reasons. But what's been going on in the high seas has been invisible to people. And this is just an example of Chinese trawlers heading out to sea the day that fishing season opened. I mean, it's amazing there are any fish left at all. So we did a project that we just announced and showed. We launched the prototype a couple weeks ago with Oceana and SkyTruth that we call Global Fishing Watch. And the idea is that these ships have transmitters that beam their position. This was developed for reasons of maritime safety, right, to avoid collision. But it can also be used to see if someone's fishing in a marine protected area or fishing in a place that's not permitted. You see some fascinating things in this data where a vessel that is supposed to be just making a transit across the Atlantic Ocean suddenly stops in the middle and starts going back and forth in a pattern that is clearly trawling. There are many other stories that the data can tell, but it's trillions of data points that are collected every year, and it's never been possible to have that all available to the public in a way that they could observe and study. So what we're looking at now is a several-month animation of global fishing traffic. So I think I'll end there. I learned a statement the other day that Daniel Moynihan had made, that you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. There are many things we can debate about how we live on the planet, right? And reasonable people can disagree. But what the work my team is trying to do with our partners, our scientists, the nonprofits, and so on, is let's at least get the facts straight about what's happening so that we can have an intelligent discussion that will elevate, all ships. No pun intended. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
So aren't you so glad that Rebecca Moore is on the case?
We're all on the case.
We're all on the case. So I want to ask you a question. All the world's woes, they all kind of come down to these data points. How do you, sitting at Google Earth Outreach, I imagine you are inundated with good causes all the time. How do you choose where to put your resources and who to help?
I thought what you were going to ask is, by the way, is this working? Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. I thought you were going to ask, why am I not terribly depressed? But, which is another good question. But that's great. My team is not huge. And so what we've tried to do is create all kinds of resources that are available. Like, for example, we'll work with Save the Elephants, and they are trying to stop illegal poaching of elephants. And they satellite tag the animals, and they're tracking them in Google Earth. And when an elephant is going into a place where they know they're in danger, they send a ranger to go shoo them away. We worked with them. They approached us, and they wanted our technical help. We worked with them because we understood that the problem they were trying to solve was really serious. There's a serious problem with poaching. They are really probably the leading, organization that's been dedicated to this for decades. And they were technically savvy enough that we knew that if we could get something going with them, they could be a model for all kinds of other organizations that are tracking elephants or tracking rhinos or trying to protect, Sumatra tigers or whatever. So when my team gets really hands-on involved, we're looking for what we call those lighthouse organizations that will, you know, spread the word when we can figure it out. But we also, like I said, if you go to our site, earth.google.com/outreach, there's a lot of information. Anyone can do anything. You don't need us. You're on the case, too.
Well, it's really fantastic. I mean, in the nonprofit world, you have, say, elephants in Africa. You have scores of small organizations and large on the case, often with duplicative efforts. So, which is fine. The problem is not solved yet. But what you are doing is something that each one of them can use, and it's not duplicative at all. It just it's incremental. It actually just adds up. Here's a question from a member of the audience. Has someone developed software used for forestry to identify species and volume of trees to estimate inventory in wooded areas?
Yeah, there's a lot of very good work being done in that area. The best sensor technology to do that is LIDAR, like airborne LIDAR. Greg Asner, who's local here at Carnegie Institute for Science, has this massively expensive, but anyway, he's flown over Peru with this airborne LIDAR and gotten extremely detailed data. The thing about something like radar or LIDAR is it's an active sensor. So it sends a signal down, it reflects off, right, the 3D structure of the trees, and comes back in a complex way. It allows you to reconstruct that 3D trunk and canopy in great detail, and then estimate the volume and so on. But that's a fairly, niche technology. That's not something that is easily available everywhere in the world. So there's a variety of different kinds of sources of data that need to come together to answer these questions.
Correctly, and I probably don't have it completely correctly, but with the Santa Cruz logging project, you worked with a conservation biologist who was able to analyze photographs that covered the proposed logging area, and she could analyze how many trees could possibly live within each measure of landscape. She could actually come up with a number of how many trees there were.
I can elaborate. We won the battle on a technicality, and win any way you can. That's how I feel about it. You know, it was a bad plan. It was going to increase fire danger. It was going to cause sedimentation in the drinking water for 100,000 people in Silicon Valley. It was going to cause public safety issues. But the reason we won is that the kind of logging permit they were applying for was a very special one that mandated you could only, it was for small landowners, you had to own less than 2,500 acres of timberland. And timberland, now this is getting kind of wonky here, but timberland is any land that is currently growing or capable of growing commercial tree species like redwoods or Douglas fir. And so Adelia Barber, who's a member of our community, she was a PhD student in ecology at UC Santa Cruz, studied the aerial imagery in detail and counted and measured every tree. And then we mapped that on Google Earth, and we added up all the acreage. And we showed that they had, by the most conservative estimate, 2,834 acres of timberland. And we presented that information at the public hearing, and you can imagine the cheers that erupted from the packed hall when we said, this plan doesn't even qualify for consideration, right? And so the press went to the logging company and said, what do you have to say about this? And they were kind of like, blah, 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 blah. And then finally they said, well, we weren't counting the trees that are hard to get to. And we're like, that's not what the law says. And we said, show your maps. And this comes back to the nature of our work. We published all that data on Google Earth. Anyone could see where we said the trees were, and you could verify, yes, in fact, that is where there were trees. They would never publish their data. They said that they had 2,002 acres of timberland, but they never showed their maps, and we won.
They won kind of in a combination of high tech and simple counting, which is kind of one of the beauties of what you can do with what you're all about. I wonder if you could tell the audience about this this guy down in San Luis Obispo who saw what your work was, and he said, he's working to stop a quarry from being built in his neighborhood.
Yeah, no, this is great. It was a quarry that was being proposed for the right near the Salinas River, and the company sent out a public notice, and very much like the public notice that I got, and they had a giant legend on the public notice that was obscuring. No one knew what was under there, but a number of people who lived in the area were concerned, but the way they published their map, it looked like there were only three or four homes that were in the area. He got tipped on to my use of Google Earth, and so his wife said he stayed up for like 48 hours straight studying what I did and then redoing it himself in his project, and he remapped their quarry plan on satellite imagery there and showed that, in fact, there were hundreds of homes that were conveniently hidden by the legend on the paper map that they had distributed. Sorry, I just think sometimes these public notices are not quite as helpful as they could be.
So this is an example of how, you know, each one of us can go home and sort of look at what are the potential impacts on where we live, and who else is living there with us. Here's a question from the audience. If there are any projects that you know of, people using this technology to save endangered species, to address this sixth mass extinction that's going on?
Yeah, that's a very big question. Yeah, so absolutely. So people are mapping where endangered species live. How does that relate to where areas are protected or not? I mentioned that when we published that forest map and forest loss over the last 10 years, many organizations took that. One of the groups that took that is WWF, because they said that I think 90% of the endangered species in the world are forest dependent. So if you want to save the species, you need to protect the forest. And people didn't have the data on where the forest was disappearing, and now they do. So that's just one example.
Just, this is maybe a little technical, or you can clarify this for me, but some of this Google Earth engine work where you can analyze these huge deforestations or land use changes, I just read a book called Dodging Extinction by a paleontologist, and he added up how much photosynthesis human beings use. We over photosynthesis budget that the sun provides, and if we stopped using fossil fuels, it would and if we stopped tomorrow, 3 billion people would die because we wouldn't have enough food to feed them, because we use up more photosynthesis by taking it out of the ground, basically using up this reserve. So one of the occult drivers of extinction is that humans are using up so much photosynthesis that we are actually depriving other species of photosynthesis. And that seems to me like something somebody could actually visualize using Google Earth Outreach.
That's a great idea. Let's get on that.
Tell somebody to do that.
I'll mention one related idea, because, again, how do you avoid being depressed? Well, you know, you can use this kind of satellite data and overlaying other information to show not only what's wrong, you know, what's at stake, what's being harmed, but you can show solutions, right? Because now people will have a better understanding, and they can say, okay, let's set aside this land, because now we all understand what's at stake. So, for example, some of the last remaining pristine rainforest in Indonesia, massive old growth trees are being logged to make toilet paper. This does not make any sense. Now, it's known that they could have plantations somewhere else on already degraded land,
and grow perfectly fine trees for toilet paper and not remove those native forests. And so there's some really interesting projects that I'm excited about getting involved with over the next few years about creating go, no-go zones on the planet. You know, E.O. Wilson, famous biologist at Harvard, said, we can't save all of nature, but let's commit to saving 50% of nature. You know, and I think it's very pragmatic to say, let's set a target and go for it. And all get on the same page, government, industry, right? Private citizens, the media, academia. Let's agree, for example, on here's some parts of the planet that are off limits. And they can be monitored now, right? So we can know whether they're being protected or not.
I think Wilson even has, there's a piece in the September Smithsonian about Wilson, and he talks about let's save half, and he shows where he thinks we should do that in these so-called mega linkages, like the spine of the continent is one that goes from the Yukon down to Mexico, and there's several on the North American continent, but they're all over the world. So he's already identified, and we could probably take somebody an afternoon or an hour to actually put them into Google Maps. So I'm going to take the occasion of this question from the audience, which is, how is Google Earth Engine being used in cultural archaeological preservation and awareness, to ask you to actually also elaborate on how Google Earth, how what you're doing with these smartphone applications is similar, different, complementary to similar ones like Open Data Kit and other types of open source products that people can use.
I'll start with the second part first, which is this is Open Data Kit. What I showed you was Open Data Kit. So that software that the Suruwi tribe was using on their phones is called Open Data Kit. It's open source software. You can run it on Android devices. It allows you to set up any sort of field survey. You could be counting birds or counting who has malaria, or you know, you can have it in different languages. And it, what's really great about it is the former way that people would do field surveys is they would go out with paper and pencil and they would write stuff or they would fill out a form, and then stacks of paper then go into some office and someone is supposed to digitize those and put them in a database, and it never happens. But now with these phones, you collect the data and it's immediately digitized. It's time-stamped, date-stamped, GPS located, can go right onto a map, right into a database. And so, for example, the Suruwi tribe, when they're using it for vigilance, if the law enforcement is going, oh, well, we didn't know about it, the Suruwi tribe can say, well, that's funny because there's a billion people looking at it in Google Maps right now, right? But getting back to the cultural applications, there's some fantastic, really inspiring sort of anthropological aspects of Google Earth. Many of these, you know, let's say the elders in these communities, if you show them a paper map, a 2D map, they cannot take what they know about their mental model of this land that they know so well and translate that to this two-dimensional abstract map. But if you show them Google Earth in 3D in the high-resolution imagery, they can immediately translate what they know to what they see there. And so there's new techniques being used now for capturing traditional knowledge. Elders working with youth, it's called direct-to-digital, where the young people interview the elders while they're looking at Google Earth, and they get the stories. This is where that happened. This is the name of that place. And here's the dance that we do there. And it's fantastic because it's preserving some aspects of culture that would otherwise be lost.
Now, some of that satellite data can get at some archaeological materials that are below ground.
Not really.
Data. I guess that's a different kind of analysis.
Yeah.
Could be imported into your maps.
People can overlay layers of information. So you could overlay, for example, that there is an excavation going on here. This is what we found. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking. But
I was just thinking, there's this site in your neighborhood in the Santa Cruz Mountains, Quiroste Cultural Preserve, where some Berkeley archaeologists and a local tribe, the Amamutsin, are doing an archaeological dig. but they know that this is the site where this cultural meeting center is, and they have analyzed that using technology, but I guess they must be different kinds of technology. But I'm sure they can be mapped.
Sort of, you know, ground penetrating LIDAR, and there are all kinds of things that.
Which is amazing, and you have something that all this can be integrated into pretty easily.
Yeah, that's the point. It's that this globe is free; it's in everyone's hands, and you can bring your own information into it and use it to tell a story or understand an issue.
So there's a lot. There's a number of questions from the audience about particular groups like World Watch, particular issues like Ebola, and how and whether you are addressing any of these. And maybe you could address sort of the whole question of, you know, what emerging trends, a really fascinating connection you're making between the malaria, the plankton bloom. You're putting together, or you're making it possible for people to put together things that would seemingly be in different categories, outbreak of disease, you know, some kind of occurrence in the ocean or temperature change. And I guess these are two different questions, but maybe you could give us a general view of the most successful applications of this kind.
Well, you know, I think the environmental ones are obvious, you know, and climate change, those sorts of things. The cultural ones that I mentioned, where people are mapping their traditional sites. Actually, this one, I find this exciting. My team just trained 100 Maori tribes people in New Zealand, and we've done trainings in Canada, and actually many parts of the world, where indigenous people's rights, their land tenure, is not being respected. And it's not specified what rights they hold to the land. But under the law in a number of these places, if an indigenous people can show a history of occupation and use of that land, then that strengthens their claim for sovereignty. And so by making these maps, like I mentioned, with you interview the elders, and, well, this is where our people are buried. This is where we gather the wood to make our arrows. This is where we gather these medicinal plants. You can, you know, suddenly you've filled the landscape, you know, with how they've used this land for generations. And this is admissible in law, right, in a court of law. So I think that's quite exciting. There are many, there are applications to human rights, you know, that, for example, you mentioned Darfur. The government of Sudan was ejecting from Darfur all of the human rights workers, the humanitarian aid workers, the journalists, and then saying, there's no villages being burned. What are you talking about, right? Well, with the high-resolution satellite data that was then in Google Earth annotated by Amnesty International and U.S. State Department and U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, you could have actually a shocking guided tour of 1,600 villages that had been burned to the ground. And even George Bush said at that time that no longer can it be denied that genocide is taking place because millions of people all over the internet can see it with their own eyes. That's the point.
I just want to point out, I think this is probably pretty clear to the audience, that, you know, this is incredible, brave new world technology that you're talking about. You know, you're really breaking this new ground, and it's a little dizzying to the rest of us, right? Because most of us are probably not rocket scientists, but there's also this incredible context that you bring to what you're doing, this sensitivity and awareness of the rights of indigenous peoples, the connection between making the connection between science and application, policy, and the environment. And this doesn't come from nowhere in you, I don't think, and it also is unusual, and I think it is one of maybe the bigger contextual reasons why you have built such an incredibly effective organization or group at Google Earth Outreach. I wondered if you might talk to the audience a little bit about where this, you know, this profound passion for justice comes from in your history. Ben.
Well, okay. And thank you for that. I mean, I do think my group is a little bit unusual at Google, because often, you know, engineers at Google build stuff in top secret for years and then kind of put it out there for the world. But we work extremely collaboratively, you know, in developing world countries, getting tattooed by indigenous, you know, tribal chiefs, whatever it takes to help kind of understand their reality so we can bridge the gap between the technology that we have and the needs that they have, and how can we meet in the middle so that this actually can make a difference. But, yeah, my family, well, my brother, the late painter Frank Moore, was an artist, and he conceived of the Red Ribbon. He was instrumental in the group Visual Aids that came up with the Red Ribbon as a symbol of compassion for people with AIDS and their caregivers. He was my older brother, and I really admired how he, through his painting and his activism, he made a difference, you know, through his work. And my dad, he won a case on a technicality. This is where I learned about winning on a technicality. He won a really important civil rights case in the 1960s that he won all the way up at the Supreme Court level. And it had to do with the NBC television station in Jackson, Mississippi in the early 60s would not accept advertising from black candidates. They would not, or they wouldn't give them airtime. They wouldn't allow black-owned businesses to buy advertising. They would roll their eyes when there was news about Martin Luther King. It was very discriminatory, and it's a whole long story, but the station ended up losing their license because they weren't serving the needs of the public. And my father won that case. Again, I won't go into all the details, but he won it on a technicality, and that's when I learned you win it any way you can.
And here's this, yes, and here's this long tradition of pro-democracy work in your family, I think, with this really amazing different directions.
Quote, you're letting me say this, so I'm going to do, hey, Dad. So he said, a citizen can do more by being well-informed on a single issue than by voicing instinctive reactions to big subjects.
Can you say that again?
Really?
Yes.
Let me see if I can say. Dad, help me here. A citizen can do more by being well-informed on a specific issue than by voicing instinctive reactions to big subjects.
That's really great. Because,
you know, again, with the stopping the logging in the Santa Cruz Mountains, after that, people come to me now and they go, oh, how can you impact the lives of millions of people? And I go, I don't know. I just know that there was this issue in the, you know, in my community. I was upset about it. I studied it deeply. I studied that plan hard. I we impacted a few people, and then it took off and took off and took off. So I think I believe in that very much. Try to do one thing, one small thing that has a small impact, and that's great.
So I'll ask you one more question that will combine a number of audience questions, which is to ask you to unpack the whole process at Google a little bit. So I have a question about, you know, how does this interest in nonprofit and for good work fit into the overall Google corporate direction and mission? How does something like, do you use designers as well as engineers to do these visualizations, and what's the interface there? How does that work kind of in a practical way? And then also, if you could give us some hints into what is big data analysis anyway?
Well, those are three different questions. I think you might have to remind me because I may not remember them all. So at Google, you know, there's google.org, which is a separate sort of part of Google that is about doing, you know, philanthropic donations. But each of the product teams, so I'm in the Google Earth and Maps team, you know, so many of us came to Google to make a difference, right? I mean, where else could you, as an engineer, work on something and have it go out the next day and a billion people are using it? It's so inspiring It's frightening, too. It's very motivating, you know, that you want to do a good job. But we realize that we can have a tremendous impact for good. And so each of the product teams, there are people that bubble up. There's YouTube for Good. There's Google Ad Grants. Has programs that are targeted to nonprofits. And, you know, they tend to bubble up very organically, and they are well supported by the company when that happens. So next question was?
You're making these visualizations.
No, that's a great question, because often software engineers make something that it may be efficient, it performs well, but it's not beautiful or fun to use. So we take user interface very, very, very seriously in our products. That's why they tend to be simple to use and we hope pleasurable to use. And these visualizations, though, these geographic visualizations, there's a lot of artistry there. There's a lot of room for creativity. They're a new kind of media, really. They're a new kind of storytelling. There are tools that we have that let you actually take people on a narrative-guided tour of the Earth and show things. And meanwhile, Robert Redford is talking about what you're looking at, right? There's a lot of... We've seen from the users of our tools some really creative stuff, and I think we're just at the beginning of that. All right, then the last one was?
What is big data analysis?
What is big data? I think I gave you some examples tonight where, you know, there was 40 years of satellite data collected. You know, just that one satellite called Landsat, it takes, let's see, goes around, you know, it's doing this polar orbit, the Earth is spinning, it's collecting, it's just continuously taking these images. 8,000 images cover the whole Earth. It takes 16 days, and then it starts all over again. And it's been doing it for 40 years. And it's now, I think, you know, 4 or 5 million scenes. It's, you know, billions of megabytes, you know, quadrillions of pixels. That's big data. And it's difficult. You can't put that, you know, on your hard drive on your laptop, right? How do you deal with that kind of data? And that's why I think the Google Cloud, the cloud computing, where we can bring many, many, you know, thousands of computers, can tackle a big problem by splitting it up into pieces, and each computer works on a piece of it, and then we stitch it all back together and give you the answer. I think that's kind of the future, is that ability to have systems that can work with big data. Does that answer the question?
That's pretty good. I mean, it's hard to understand it, really. You have 66,000 computers that you used for...
Just to be really clear, we split up the Earth into 66,000 small pieces, right? You can just imagine, right? You just split it all up, and each computer works on a piece of it, and then we stitch it all back together. Yeah,
those 66,000 computers.
They're in Google's data centers. We have data centers all over the world. You should not even know or care. I don't know where that particular computation took place. It might have been in Atlanta. It might have been in Norway. I mean, you know.
Kind of, you know, it's very abstract. Like, we don't know where it happens. I remember going to NASA Ames Research Center at Moffett Field, where, the second most powerful computing power in the world. Sometimes it's number one, sometimes it's number two. And it's basically like a room full of boxes.
Hmm.
You know, it doesn't look like what it is. It's just a bit of a mind boggle. It is still abstract, right? If we don't know exactly how computers...
What we've tried to do with the Google Earth Engine platform is make it really easy, so that in just a few lines of instruction, you can go tell Google to do this unbelievable deforestation analysis, because we've done a lot of work to make that easy to do, or look for malaria, or, you know, that kind of thing.
It's really, really amazing. Well, I want to thank you, Rebecca, mostly for being you and doing what you're doing. It makes me feel better.
Here's to technicalities.
Let's find a few more of them. So let's thank Rebecca Moore, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.